Job chapter 40 says, "Moreover, the Lord answered Job." Now, if you know where we are, God has begun to speak, finally, after 35 chapters of listening to men. And God begins to speak. He's giving Job this exam on the natural world: weather, rain, floods, hell, light, darkness, planets. And then he travels into the world of biology and questions Job on 10 different life forms, 10 different animals. And then at the end of all of that, now chapter 40 says, "Moreover, the Lord answered Job and said, Shall he that contendeth with the Almighty instruct him? He that reproveth God, let him answer it." Now let's hear from you, Job. Let's hear what you have to say. "Then Job answered the Lord and said, Behold, I am vile, small, insignificant. What shall I answer thee? I will lay my hand upon my mouth. Once have I spoken, I will not answer, yea, twice, but I will proceed no further." Job, after this initial encounter with the Lord, says, "Come to think of it, Lord, I'm just vile, and if you don't mind, I'm just going to shut up from now on." Then answered the Lord, verse 6, unto Job out of the whirlwind, and said, "No, gird up your loins now. This test is half over, Job. Like a man, I will demand of thee, and declare thou unto me." I want you to give me an answer. "Wilt thou also disannul my judgment? Wilt thou condemn me that thou mayest be righteous?" You know, Job, is that what you're doing with your suffering? Is that what you're doing? And you see the way that I run the universe, the weather, these systems from large to small. Job, are you going to disannul me because of your perspective? Are you going to condemn me that you might be righteous? Do you think you know what should be happening? Now, I don't know about you. Certainly, there's enough times when I've said, "Lord, if I was you, or Lord, if you just cooperate, we could get great stuff done here. Hast thou an arm like God? Or canst thou thunder with a voice like him? Deck thyself now with majesty and excellency, and array thyself with glory and beauty. Cast abroad the rage of thy wrath, and behold everyone that is proud, and abase him. Look on everyone that is proud, and bring him low. Tread down the wicked in their place. Hide them in the dust together, and bind their faces in secret. Then will I also confess unto thee that thine own right hand can save," that you can deliver yourself. So he's challenged now into this kind of other realm. It's an interesting combination of things, saying, "Job, if you can't control the natural universe, if you don't understand the planetary systems and the weather systems and the migratory patterns of animals and the different things I've set up, Job, how are you then going to make a moral judgment? How are you going to govern the moral universe? Can you tread down the proud? Can you deal with them in your wrath? Can you crush the wicked under your foot, Job? If you can't judge the natural universe, how are you going to judge the moral universe? And if you can't judge the moral universe, then why are you contending with me? Are you going to justify yourself and say that what I'm doing or what I've allowed to happen in your life is wrong?" He's challenging Job here. And certainly as we move on, I think we're going to see some interesting pictures of God's ability to tread down here. Verse 15, "Behold now Behemoth." Now, I'm reading from a Cambridge, King James, and my translation says, "Behold now Behemoth," with a gloss in the column, a note that says, "The elephant," as some think. Now, I don't know what yours says, but we're going to head into these two strange creatures, Behemoth or Behemoth and Leviathan. These two creatures get more print than the previous 10 different animal species combined. So we're going to look at these very interesting creatures. We'll be honest about them. Some of your translations say that this is a wild ox. Some say it's a hippopotamus. Some say it's an elephant. Let's look. I don't think any of that makes sense. I think we're just afraid to say what it might be. Behold now, behemoth, which I made with thee. Now, by the way, a behemoth is really just the beast. It's used about 185 times in the Hebrew Old Testament. Sometimes it's translated cattle, sometimes, but it's used of great beasts also. And he's going to say this is the chief of the ways of God, this behemoth. So, behold now, behemoth, which I made with thee, he eateth grass as an ox. Lo now, his strength is in his loins. Oh, so far that could be an elephant, strong loins, hippo, I guess. His force is in the navel of his belly. I'm not sure whether he's got an innie or an outie there, but I'm not sure what that has to do with elephants and hippos. Now, here's where we disqualify, I think. He moveth his tail like a cedar. And whenever the Bible speaks of cedars, it's speaking of cedars in the context of the greatness of the cedars and the worth of the wood of the cedar in the temple. But I don't know if you've noticed a hippo with a cedar for a tail. They have that little flap of skin. It's pretty much unnoticeable. And elephants have that little funky tail with the stringy hair on the end of it. Whatever this creature is, has a tail like a cedar. So we're looking here at something interesting, I believe. He moveth his tail like a cedar. The sinews of his stones, of his thighs, are wrapped together. Tremendous strength in his tendons. His bones are as strong as pieces of brass. His bones are like bars of iron. He is the chief, I guess in the sense, the largest, the foremost, of the ways of God. God reflected in creation here. He that made him can make his sword to approach unto him. God is able to deal with him, make him extinct, evidently, or to slay, if he so chooses. Surely the mountains bring him forth food. We don't see elephants or hippos in the mountains, usually. Where all the beasts of the field play, he lieth under the shady trees, in the covert of the reed and fens, King James, which is swamps. The shady trees cover him with their shadow. The willows of the brook compass him about. Behold, he drinketh up a river and hasteth not. He trusteth that he can draw up Jordan into his mouth. He taketh it with his eyes, his nose pierceth through snares. There's no trap in anything. So we have this strange animal here, the greatest of God's creation on land. Leviathan will be in the sea. A tail like a cedar. I wonder if we are looking here at some... And obviously if we're looking at here, it's not prehistoric, is it? Because here's Job writing. Some form of dinosaur. It would seem that way to me, but my own opinion. You know, it says here he layeth in the fens, in the swamps, and we even have sightings today in between the Congo and Zaire. There's at least 30,000 square miles of swamp. Some say up to 55,000 square miles of swamp there. And there's continual reports, even up to the last decade, of something that resembles a brontosaurus, plesiosaurus that lives there, and the surrounding tribes, many of them speaking different languages, who have talked to explorers and zoologists and so forth, give the same descriptions, even though they are tribes that don't intermingle, don't know each other. And interesting. If you were here when Ken Ham was here, he has some of these little pamphlets he carries with him and talks about some of those things. When Alexander the Great and his soldiers marched into India, they found the Indians worshipped a huge hissing reptile that lived in a cave. China. We'll talk about renowned for its dragon stories and dragons, prominent in Chinese culture. England has its story of St. George, who slew a dragon in a cave. There was a story of a 10th century Irishman who wrote of his encounter of what appears to be a stegosaurus. The 1500s, European Scientific Handbook, Historia Animalium, listed several animals that we would call dinosaurs as still alive. Well-known naturalist of the time, Ulysses Andropodis, recorded an encounter between a peasant named Baptista and a dragon whose description fits that of a small dinosaur. The encounter was on May 13, 1572, near Bologna in Italy. The peasant killed the dragon. He just goes on and on with different things. The explorers in the Congo that have mentioned these things. Interesting, in many of the cave drawings, there is not only the woolly mammoth drawn, but there are dinosaurs. Brontosaurus, Tyrannosaurus, and one of the things that bothers scientists who want to make the Earth millions of years old is they're willing to admit that after the Ice Age, the mastodon survived and therefore a native of some region of the world could, on the cave walls, draw a picture of a mastodon, but they don't like to admit that man coexisted with the giant reptiles that we have so many of the skeletons of, because they're also drawn right on the cave walls next to the mastodons in some places now. Interesting thing about reptiles is this, is that a reptile will grow as long as it lives. I remember when I was a kid, I got a couple of alligators, and the guy at the pet store told me, and I had lizards and turtles and a big snapping turtle and spiders and snakes, I had everything, but I got a couple of alligators, and the guy at the pet store said, well, the larger container you put them in, the faster they'll grow. And we had this swimming pool in the backyard. It was a kid's pool. It was like 3 foot deep and 10 foot across. And my sister's 2 years younger than me. I bribed her, paid her off or something to tell my mom she wasn't interested in the pool so I could put the alligators in there. And I put the alligators in the spring and left them in there all summer and fed them mice. And I had a great time and had a log in there. But they started this big by the end of the summer. They grew fast. And they bit, too. They were nasty. I had to get rid of them. Traded them in for a bunch of other stuff at the pet store at the end of the summer. Dinosaur eggs, the largest dinosaur eggs that have been found, are about the size of a football. Most of them are about the size of an ostrich egg. And yet you look at the size of the creature, ultimately, that comes from that. You think of the longevity before the flood. You have Adam, his descendants, living to be 900, 800 years old. So you look at one of these Nile crocs today. They say 150 years old, 18 foot long to 20 foot long, some of the really big ones. Imagine if they lived 800 years. Imagine when there was longevity. You could have reptile eggs that were this big that produced something that grew massive. Of course, the question, well, how did Noah get those things on the ark? I wasn't there. I don't know. I can't imagine he brought a full-grown Tyrannosaurus Rex on the ark with his wife. That would have been one mess. But he could have brought mature beasts that were small, that were the size of an elephant or smaller, the longevity hadn't produced a monstrous size yet. It's quite possible. They live contemporary with man. And even outside of Jerusalem, one of the towns there, they have much like a Paluxy. They have a dinosaur footprint with a human print both in it and alongside of it. So behemoth. I think we're looking at something that may have survived the flood, may have been on the ark, something, you know, Job's going to live 147 years after the end of the book. He lives to be over 200 years old. He's certainly from the patriarchal period. Job is certainly the oldest book in the Bible. Moses would write the Pentateuch many, many years after this. So Job is writing of things that no doubt probably behemoth is extinct today. Maybe some remnants here and there. Don't ask me about Nessie. I don't know anything about Nessie. Or Bigfoot or any. I don't know anything about any of those. But Job? What about Behemoth? I have the ability, whenever I want to put my sword to this creature, to, as it were, crush it, to bring it down. Job, do you? Chapter 41. Canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook? Or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down? Now, Leviathan. Your Bible may say crocodile. You know, by the time we, to me at least, by the time we get over to verse 19, crocodiles disappeared for me a little bit anyway. Out of his mouth go burning lamps, sparks of fire leap out. Out of his nostrils go smoke as a seething pot in a cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. No croc that I've seen lately. Leviathan. In Genesis chapter 1, you don't have to turn there. In verse 21, where it says, "And God created great whales and every living creature that moveth within the waters," the word there, tannin, is most often translated in the Old Testament, dragon. It's translated whale three times, there and two other places. It's translated serpent about five times. It's translated dragon probably at least a dozen times. It's translated sea monster once. So what this great creature was that God created in the sea, we're not sure of, but here Leviathan, certainly probably a picture of that. Now, Leviathan is mentioned, and I will read these verses. You don't have to turn there. In Psalm 74, it says, "Thou didst divide the sea by thy strength. Thou breakest the heads of the dragons in the waters." Psalm 74:13. In Psalm 104, it says, "So is the great and wide sea, wherein are things creeping innumerable, both small and great beast. There go the ships. There is that Leviathan whom thou hast made to play therein." Isaiah chapter 27 says, now, and by the way, it's coupled with some interesting verses in the end of chapter 26. I'll read these. "Thy dead men shall live together with my dead body shall they arise." So people who say the resurrection is not in the Old Testament, this is Isaiah 26. "Awake and sing, ye that dwell in the dust, for thy dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth shall cast out the dead. Then come, my people, enter thou into thy chambers, shut thy doors about thee, hide thyself, as it were, for a little moment, till the indignation be overpast." That's an interesting picture of the rapture in the Old Testament, I think. "For behold, the Lord cometh out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth also shall disclose her blood, and shall no more cover her slain." 27 begins, "In that day the Lord with his sore and great and strong sword shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea." So Leviathan, now we come to this interesting picture here of this creature back in Job. "Canst thou draw out Leviathan with a hook, or his tongue with a cord which thou lettest down? Canst thou put a hook into his nose, or bore his jaw through with a thorn? Will he make many supplications unto thee? Will he speak soft words unto thee? Will he make a covenant with thee? Wilt thou take him for a servant forever? Wilt thou play with him as with a bird, or wilt thou bind him for thy maidens?" In other words, Job, you have any chance of dealing with this creature, of domesticating this creature, of doing anything with this creature that's in the sea? "Shall the companions make a banquet of him? Shall they part him among the merchants? Canst thou fill his skin with barbed irons, or his head with fish spears? Lay thine hand upon him, remember the battle, and do no more." Yeah, good advice, I know. Behold, the hope of him is in vain. Shall not one be cast down even at the sight of him? None is so fierce that dare stir him up. Who then is able to stand before me? Who hath prevented me, or who hath given to me that I should repay him? Job, if you can't stand before Leviathan, who I've made, who I can crush at will, how are you going to stand before me and present your case morally? Who hath given to me that I should repay him whatsoever under the whole heaven? Whatever exists is mine, the cattle on 1,000 hills. I will not conceal his parts, nor his power, nor his comely proportion, his beautiful proportions, whatever this means. Who can discover the face of his garment? Who can come to him with his double bridle? You know, is the crocodile or Steve Irwin going to wrestle with this thing? You know, who's going to put a bridle on this? Who can open the doors of his face? His teeth are terrible round about. His scales, not real noticeable on a croc. His scales are his pride, shut up together as with a close seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They stick together that they cannot be sundered, separated. By his kneesings, which is an old King James word for sneezings. So when someone kneeses, you can say, God bless you. By his kneesings, a light doth shine. His eyes are like the eyelids of the morning. Out of his mouth go burning lamps. So you don't want to be around Leviathan when he's got a cold. Out of his mouth go burning lamps and sparks of fire. They leap out. Out of his nostrils go a smoke as of a seething cauldron. His breath kindleth coals, and a flame goeth out of his mouth. Sounds, now, verse 22, by the way, for those of you who think this is a whale, in his neck. I don't know the last time you saw a whale with a neck. It goes from his head to his tail, his neck. In his neck remaineth strength, and sorrow is turned into joy before him. Now, I do believe this creature now is going to morph in front of us. I believe that up until this point, God has been pointing to a literal creature. Something probably now extinct. Because I have a penchant for these kinds of things, I have several books on biological anomalies, weather anomalies, anomalies in anthropology, and this one's got a whole section, and if you don't mind, I'll bore you with a few things. And these are all reports from sea captains. They're all dated. There's a whole section on them, remarkably. Great Sea Serpent, Dean LPW, zoologist, 1847. This one is Scientific America, 1848. When the Daedalus frigate, Captain McGee, arrived at Portsmouth, England, was on her passage home from the Cape of Good Hope, and St. Helen, her captain, and most of her officers and crew, at 3 o'clock one afternoon, saw a great serpent. The creature was 20 minutes in sight of the frigate, passed under her quarter. Its head appeared to be about 4 feet out of the water. There was about 60 feet of its body in the straight line of the surface. It is calculated that there must have been under the water a length of 30 or 40 more feet. The diameter of the exposed part of the body, what was breaking the water, was about 16 inches wide. And when it extended its jaws, which were full of large jagged teeth, they seemed sufficiently capacious to admit a tall man standing up between them. Here's a man named Woodward, zoologist, 1848. I, the undersigned Joseph Woodward, captain of the Adamant schooner of Higham, being on my route from Penobosc to Hingham, steering west-northwest, I'll say some of these words wrong if you don't mind, being about 10 leagues from the coast, perceived last Sunday at 2 p.m. something on the surface of the water, which seemed to me about the size of a large boat. Supposing that it might be part of a wreck of a ship, I approached it, but when I was within a few yards of it, it appeared to my great surprise and that of the whole crew that it was a monstrous serpent. When I approached nearer, it coiled itself up, instantly uncoiling itself again, and withdrew with extreme rapidity. On my approaching again, it coiled itself up a second time and placed itself at a distance of 60 feet at the most from the box of the ship. I had one of my guns loaded with a cannonball and musket balls. I fired at the head of the monster. My crew and myself distinctly heard the ball and bullets striking against the body from which they rebounded as if they had struck against a rock. The serpent shook his head and tail in an extraordinary manner and advanced towards the ship with open jaws. I had caused the cannon to be reloaded and pointed it at his throat. But he had come so near that all the crew were seized with terror, and we thought only of getting out of his way. He almost touched the vessel, and had not I tacked as I did, he would have certainly come on board. He dived, but in a moment we saw him appear again, with his head on one side of the vessel and his tail on the other, as if he was going to lift us up and upset us. However, we did not feel any shock. He remained 5 hours near us, only going backward and forward. The fears with which we at first were inspired subsided. We were able to examine him attentively. I estimate that his length was at least that twice of my schooner, that is to say 130 feet. His head was a full 12 to 14 foot. The diameter of the body below the neck is no less than 6 foot in diameter. The size of his head in proportion to the body. He is of blackish color. His ear holes are about 12 feet from the extremity of his head. In short, the whole has a terrible look. When he coils himself up, he places his tail in such a manner that it aids him in a darting forward with great force. He moves in all directions with the greatest facility and astonishing rapidity. The foregoing statement, formally signed and sworn by the captain at Higham, by Captain Woodworth, on the 12th of May. This is 1848. I mean, I've got these. I've got pages of these. I'll read just a few to you, okay? These are kind of funny things. This is an extract from a journal here, a copy of an extract from the Board of Trade Meteorological Journal kept by Captain Harrington of the ship Castellon from Bombay to Liverpool. Ship Castellon, December 12, 1857, northeast end of St. Helena, bearing northwest, distance 10 miles. At 6:30 p.m., strong breezes cloudy, ship sailing 12 miles per hour. While myself and the officers were standing on the lee side of the poop, there's a British gentleman here, looking towards the island, we were startled by the sight of a huge marine animal which reared his head out of the water within 20 yards of the ship. When it suddenly disappeared for about half a minute and then made its appearance in the same manner again, showing us distinctly its neck and head about 10 to 12 feet out of the water. Its head was shaped like a long-run buoy, and I suppose the diameter to have been 7 or 8 feet, the largest part, with a kind of scroll or tuft of loose skin encircling it about 2 feet from the top. The water was discolored for several hundred feet from his head, so much so that at first appearance my impression was that the ship was in broken water, produced, as I suppose, by some volcanic agency since the last time I passed this island. But the second appearance completely dispelled those fears and assured us that it was the monster of extraordinary length, which appeared to be moving slowly towards land. The ship was going too fast to enable us to reach the masthead in time to form a correct estimate of its length, but from what we saw from the deck, we conclude that it must have been over 200 feet long. The boatswain and several of the crew who observed it from the topgallant forecastle state that it must have been more than double the length of the ship, in which case it could have been close to 500 foot long. Be that as it may, I am convinced that it belonged to the serpent tribe. It was a dark color about the head. It was covered with several white spots. Having a press of canvas on the ship at the time, I was unable to round to it without risk, and therefore was precluded from getting another sight of this Leviathan of the deep. You know, I just have another sea serpent here, 1859. Here's one by a zoologist, 1863. Following is a copy of the letter from an officer of the African mail steamer Athenia, addressed to a gentleman of his town. Africa Royal Mail Screw Steamer Athenia, Cape Psalms, Cape Palamas, May 16th, 1863. My dear sir, all doubts may now be set at rest about the great sea serpent. On the 6th of May, the African Royal Mail steamship Athenia, on her passage from Tenerife to Bathurst, fell in with one. At about 7 a.m., John Chapel, quartermaster at the wheel, saw something floating towards the ship. He called the attention of the Reverend Mr. Smith and another passenger who were on the deck at the time. On the nearing the steamer, it was discovered to be a large snake about 100 feet long, of dark brown color, head and tail out of the water, the body slightly under. On its head was something like a mane or seaweed. The body was about the size round of our main mast. You are at liberty to publish this, he ends. 1877, another sighting. 1883, another sighting. 1886, another sighting. 1903, sighting. 1957, sighting. This is an interesting one. 1930. This one passed within 30 yards, starboard side. Getting very good view as we passed close to the creature. It lifted its head once or twice as if looking at us. The head was in appearance black and glossy, no protrusions such as ears, in shape about that of a cow head. The top edge of the neck was just awash, and it curved to almost a semicircle as the creature moved its head as if to follow us with its eyes. The dorsal fin was a black equilateral triangle, which rose at times till the peak was estimated to be 4 or 5 feet out of the water. Three independent estimates made on board gave the length of the neck to the dorsal fin 15, 120 foot, 128 foot. The head appeared to have a patch of whitish flesh in the front. Sounds like one of the other ones, like that around a cow's nostrils. I mean, it just goes on, describes this. It says the dorsal fin, flexible, occasional. The Hillary being on patrol at that time, the unfortunate creature was used as a target for an anti-submarine practice with 6-pounders at about 1,200 yards range. A direct hit having apparently been scored, it disappeared. No trace remaining. A few days later, May 25, 1917, the ship was torpedoed and sunk, taking with her all her logs, journals, etc., recording the sea serpent incident. As described, the creature seems to have borne the most striking resemblance to that seen off of the Brazilian coast in 1905. I mean, this just, here's over 1,000 witnesses to this one in Ogopaga, Canada, the lake monster up there. There's one other one here I really like. I'll be with you in a minute. Well, there's here, they have records of the one in the Congo that Ken Ham talks about. This is really fascinating. This is 1916 in China. Irwin J. O'Malley, scientific from the Scientific American, the journal. During the latter part of a holiday trip in the Yangtze Gorge, undertaken by my wife and myself in November 1915, we met Mr. M. Hewlett, a British consul of I Chang, and his wife in their company spent a day in the Yangtze Gorge, landing at various points, climbing the cliffs, exploring some of the numerous caves. While exploring a large cave on the right bank of the river, about 1 mile above the customs station at Ping Shang Pa, we discovered the fossils we are about to describe. The cave is reputed by the Chinese to extend for over 20 miles to a point near Yichang. It is reported that a party of blue jackets from the HMS Snipe spent 3 days in the cave some years ago and that they failed to reach the end. Evidence that this party penetrated beyond the point where the discovery was made exists in the name of their ship painted on the cave wall at a point considerably further in. The Chinese name for the cave is Shen Kan Tzu, which means the holy shrine. The one of the characters forming the word for Khan is the Chinese character for dragon. A large rock is seen at the entrance of the cave. It describes that. And after proceeding some 100 yards inside the cave, we found ourselves walking on a peculiar ridge. In the inside cave, we found ourselves walking on a peculiar ridge in order to avoid the surrounding pools of water. This ridge curves backwards and forwards across the width of the cave like curves of a large serpent, the suggestion being so strong that we lowered our lamps in order to examine the ridge more closely. To our astonishment and delight, we found that we were in the very truth walking along a perfect fossil of some huge reptile. Further inspection revealed the presence of 6 or 8 of these enormous monsters. Having taken a few small specimens of loose portions of scale for examination, so there were still scales there, in better light, we left, planning to return the following morning for the purpose of measurement. On our return the following morning, we selected one of the largest fossils, lying for a great part of its length isolated from the others. The coils of the remainder being rather entangled, the isolated portion measuring 70 feet, so that it is absolutely certain that the length of it is at least 70 feet, and as far as we could ascertain, the same specimen extended for another 60 or 70 feet. However, I admit an error is possible here, owing to the interlacing coils of these reptiles. The depth of the body seemed in the foreground of the first illustration at over 2 feet. The head is partially buried in the cave wall and appears to be large, flat head, similar to that of Morosaurus camperi. About 12 or 14 foot from the head are 2 legs, and they are seen partially uncovered, and again, 2 or more at about 50 feet from the head. The fact that several persons have penetrated this cave in former years beyond the point where the discovery is made seems to indicate the fossils have been recently uncovered, probably by heavy discharges of water through the cave. It seems probable these reptiles were trapped by some volcanic disturbance, starved to death. The size of the bodies compared to their length wouldn't indicate this. A point of peculiar interest is the resemblance to the Chinese dragon of these fossils. I believe that it has heretofore been supposed that the Chinese borrowed their idea of the dragon from Western mythology. The discovery has created a great stir among the local Chinese and foreigners who are daily flocking to view the fossils. I am attempting to interest the Chinese authorities in Peking and also the Chinese Monument Society in order that the specimens may be preserved before they're damaged. So he's uncovering these huge dragons in these caves. Leviathan, interesting creature. Was it a fire-breathing dragon? You know, there's fire-breathing dragons in almost every culture around the world. If you read Henry Morris's commentary, he's a scientist on the Book of Job, he mentions some of the scientists having compartments in their head that they feel may have been to mix gases that when they hit the oxygen exploded. Now, you know the bombardier beetle does that. It has 2 different chemicals it mixes and it shoots fire out of its tail and it explodes and it smokes and scares away other bugs and stuff. Are we dealing with something here that was extinct, some great dragon? I think we're dealing with some sea serpent, some great creature that is extinct at this point in time. God uses Leviathan, though, to move into a different picture here. When he says his heart, verse 24, is as firm as a stone, yea, as hard as a piece of the nether millstone. When he raiseth up himself, the mighty are afraid. By reason of the breakings they purify themselves. The sword of him that layeth at him cannot hold, the spear, the dart, nor the habergeon. He esteemeth iron as straw and brass as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. Sling stones are turned with him to stubble. Darts are counted as stubble. He laugheth at the shaking of a spear. Sharp stones are under him. He spreadeth sharp pointed things upon the mire. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot, which is one of the interesting observations here in one of these accounts. He maketh the deep to boil like a pot. He maketh the sea like a pot of ointment. He maketh a path to shine after him. One would think the deep to be hoary, or a white wake follows him. Upon the earth there is not his like, who is made without fear. He beholdeth all high things. He is a king over all of the children of pride. So I think by the time we get to that last verse, there's an embodiment here also of something spiritual. You remember in Ezekiel 28 when God is speaking about the king of Tyre, and all of a sudden he starts to talking about he was in Eden in his perfect state. He was the cherubim that led worship, and Lucifer then is viewed as a power behind this king of Tyre that was a powerful king in the day, the spiritual forces behind it. Here, God speaking to Job as he comes to the end, it says, all of the children, he is the king over all of the children of pride. And I think Job is seeing here now something that only God could crush under his heel, because God had said, can you crush the proud and the wicked under your heel, Job? And God now saying that he has complete control over this, the children of pride, the sons of pride, literally. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that thou canst do everything, and that no thought can be withholden from thee, and nothing is restrained to you. Who is he that hideth counsel without knowledge? Now remember, God had said this to Job. When God began to speak to him, he said, who is this that darkeneth counsel with words without knowledge? Job owns that now. Who is this that hideth counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that which I understood not, things too wonderful for me which I knew not. Lord, I didn't know what I was saying. Yes, I'm the one who utters, you know, counsel without knowledge, but I didn't know what I was saying. Hear, I beseech thee, and I will speak. I will demand of thee and declare thou unto me. God said that to him. Job, you speak. Demand of me, then I'll answer you. And he says, I'll do it, but what I have to say is this. I have heard of thee by the hearing of the ear, but now mine eye seeth thee. Our experience needs to be that also. Eye hath not seen, ear hath not heard, neither has entered in the heart of man, the mind of man, the things that God has prepared for those who love him. By his Spirit, God has made those things real to us. He has allowed us to see with our heart. Again, the unsaved, the God of this world, had blinded the minds of those who don't see, lest they should see the light of the glorious gospel of Christ shining. So, we can say that. Before I was saved, Lord, there was a day when I heard of thee with the hearing of the ear. People were witnessing to me. I was arguing with Christian friends. But then there came a time when I said, but now I see reality. No longer just something I've heard about, Lord. You've come before the vision of my heart. He says, mine eye seeth, is in the process of seeing you. Wherefore, I abhor myself, and I repent in dust and in ashes. And it was so that after the Lord had spoken these words unto Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz, the Temanite, my wrath is kindled against thee. And that's bad if he can crush Behemoth and Leviathan at his whim and he's mad at Eliphaz. And against thy two friends, for you have not spoken of me the thing that is right as my servant Job hath. Therefore, take unto you now 7 bullocks and 7 rams, and go, here it is again, to my servant Job, and offer up for yourselves a burnt offering, here it is again, and my servant Job shall pray for you, for him will I accept, lest I deal with you after your folly, here it is again, in that you have not spoken of me the thing which is right, like my servant Job. My servant Job, 4 times in these 2 verses, twice God says, my wrath is kindled because you have misrepresented me. And this is in the most dire circumstances, when someone is hurting, when something has something wrong in his life. And look, there's a whole theology out there today that would say, well, the reason you're sick is because you're not tithing. The reason you're sick is because there's a lack of faith in your life. The reason you're sick is because there's sin in your life. There's a whole theology out there today, like the argument of Job's friends, that the righteous prosper, those who have faith prosper, and the wicked suffer. And the problem is, of course, as we look at the news, as we look at the world we live in, there are many people that are unrighteous, that are wicked, that are prospering, sitting on top of this world. And there are many righteous that are being persecuted, martyred, suffering. And for us to look at someone who is suffering, someone's having a difficult time, and say to them, hey, God doesn't love you, God's mad at you, man, he must be dealing with you, look at all the rotten stuff going on in your life, you must be on God's bad side. God hates to be misrepresented. He hates to be misrepresented. We see that again with Moses, when he struck the rock, instead of speaking to the rock, wasn't allowed in the promised land. We see it in Matthew 23 at the Lord's scathing address at the Pharisees, Sadducees, and scribes because of their misrepresentation of him. We see the warning throughout the Bible of false teachers whose judgment slumbereth not, is alive and it's working. They're facing the day when God is going to deal with them because they're false teachers, false prophets. They misrepresent. God here says, my servant Job 4 times, he didn't misrepresent me like you guys did. I want you to go offer 7 bullocks, 7 rams, and go to my servant Job and have him pray for you, and lest I deal with you according to your folly, and because you have not spoken to me the thing that is right, like my servant Job. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite and Zophar the Naamathite went and did according as the Lord commanded them. I bet they did. And the Lord also accepted Job. And the Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Doesn't say the Lord turned the captivity of Job because he prayed for his friends. It says the Lord turned the captivity of Job in this time when he prayed for his friends. Not because. Also, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. What a great picture. Job, not bitter. Whatever he had seen of God, whatever this display was that caused Job to fall down and say, I've heard, but now I've seen. Because I've seen, you know, I abhor myself in dust and ashes and repentance. He could hold nothing against these other men at that point when he saw the glory and the majesty and the beauty of God, and realized that he had spoken without knowledge and had misunderstood so much. And isn't it interesting? Look, the answer why is never given in the book of Job. Why did Job suffer? We know there was this contest behind the scenes. Job himself uses the word why 16 times in 35 chapters. Why? 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 Like we do when we're suffering, when we hurt. Quite often. Why, God? This is unfair. Why are you letting this happen? You love me. I'm your child, and so forth. It was never answered. It's almost as though the vision he has of God becomes the answer to all of the unanswered questions he has within himself. We're sitting here this evening, and I'm sure if we had a choice, would you rather have God answer some of the difficult questions you have in your life right now? Maybe you're asking God, why are you letting this happen, Lord? Would you rather have him answer why? Or would you rather have him descend in his chariot like he did before Ezekiel and manifest his presence here in the room? like when the cherubim fall down and say, "Holy, holy, holy, Lord God Almighty, the Lamb of God on His throne." You know, would you rather see that or have Him answer, "Well, why do you do this, God? And why do you let that happen?" You know, isn't it interesting? The question why is never answered, because it's almost as God knows what Job really wanted to know was not why. What Job really wanted to know was who. He wanted to know me. There's something that he needed to see about me and my moral standard and my moral government in nature, in the spiritual realm, to know that there was nothing wrong. There was no anger on my part. There was no judgment on his life. The Lord turned the captivity of Job when he prayed for his friends. Also, the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came there unto him all of his brethren. Now that happens, doesn't it? When you're poor, nobody shows up for lunch. When you have twice as much and you're prospered, all your buddies, like getting a built-in pool. All of a sudden you have company all the time. Or you get a pickup truck and all of a sudden your relatives want help moving everything. Then came there unto him all his brethren and all his sisters and all they that had been of his acquaintances before, and they did eat bread with him in his house, and they bemoaned him. Oh, that was terrible, Job, what happened to you? Where were you? And now, it says, they comforted him over all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. Now, they see they still have the story wrong. Every man also gave him a piece of money, and every one an earring of gold. But I guarantee you this, Job is finding no comfort or security in his comforters, in his relatives, or in his gold. What he has seen of the Lord has set him aside for the rest of his life, has ruined him for this world. Lord, you are more precious than silver. Lord, you are more costly than gold. We sing this song. Whatever Job's perspective of his family and his wealth and his flocks was before all of this transpired, I guarantee you it is vastly different now. Job did not see these things about God until he was scraping himself with potsherds, until his friends were maligning him, until every cow and every camel and every ox was gone. Somehow Job, looking up in that adversity, saw something of God. And again, it isn't adversity itself that does that. If it's just adversity, we can become bitter. We can become disillusioned. As Christians, saying, "Lord, you love me," and all of these terrible things happen. No, what God did was God stepped into that adversity and revealed something of himself. There was God's sovereign will involved, because he doesn't break a bruised reed and he doesn't quench a smoking flax. He never forsakes his own. And he stepped into that adversity when he knew Job was broken and open, and revealed something so wonderful of himself that Job never found security in these things, I guarantee you, again after that. So the Lord blessed the latter end of Job more than his beginning. For he had 14,000 sheep. Now he had 7,000 in the first chapter. He had 6,000 camels. He had 3,000 in the first chapter. He had 1,000 yoke of oxen. That's twice what he had in the first chapter. And he had 1,000 she-asses. Twice as much, the whole list. Doubled his wealth. He had also 7 sons. So God is replaced. He's got 7 more sons. And 3 daughters. And he called the name of his first... Now these are his daughters. His first daughter, Jemima. What are you laughing about? Which means dove. She opened a syrup factory as time went on. You, of course, know that. The name of the second daughter was Keziah. Where we from cassia, the herb, the odor of cinnamon. So the first one, her name means dove. She's beautiful. The second one, cassia, which is the odor of cinnamon. That's a nice girl to go out with. And the name of the third was Karen Hapak, which means horn of paint. Now, that sounds silly to you, I know, but it has to do certainly with the eye makeup that, you know, in early Egypt, you see that the idea is she had beautiful eyes. So, dove, cinnamon, and horn of paint. And in all the land were no women found so fair as the daughters of Job. In that day, it was a blessing. Today, it'd be a nightmare for a dad. Their father gave them inheritance among their brethren. Now, by the way, we don't know where Job's wife is in this. There are people who immediately want to say, this is another wife. Because that first one said, curse God and die. And God got rid of her. I don't know if it's that simple. Because I think a woman who loses all 10 of her children in one day, who loses everything, she says, Job, why are you hanging on? Job, just... And I think, you see, there's a possibility she may have said it in a sense, Job, leave. You know, I've gone to the hospital to visit someone who's suffering and hanging on a heart-lung machine, and you say to them, you know what, leave. Go be with Jesus. Well, the family's going to be okay. And sometimes people won't let go until you give them permission. And there is those who feel that Job's wife, more in that sense, was saying, Job, just... And there's even a controversy over the word curse there. So we don't know. We don't want to write her off too fast. Might be another wife, I don't know. No evidence one way or another. But if God has blessed him with double everything he had in the beginning, it may be his wife here. I don't know, maybe that's a warning to wives. Not to have that information. If you say curse God and die to your husband, we really don't know what happens to you. I don't know. It's a thought. He gave them inheritance among their brethren, and after this, Job lived 140 years. So, they estimate he was 70 years old in the first chapter after this trial, which went on for a number of months. Many feel around 5 to 7 months. Job lives 140 more years. So if everything else is doubled, if these years are doubled, he would have been 70 years in the beginning of the book. He lives 140 more years. This guy lives to be 210 years old. And saw his sons and his sons' sons even 4 generations. So he saw his sons, his grandsons, his great-grandsons, and his great-great-grandsons. So Job died, being old, I'll say, and full of days, and never knew why. Never knew why. He repented. You know, he had said, would to God I had never been born. Lord, why did you let me come out of my mother's womb? He cursed the day that he was born. He said things, foolish things in his suffering. He was not suffering because of sin, but he did say foolish things in his suffering, like many of us would in that much pain and agony. And somehow, as he realizes God's moral purity, God's holiness, God's beauty, and he breaks before the Lord... You know, here the best years were still ahead of him. He hadn't been robbed, really. And I wonder, if you were to say to Job, ask him. You're going to see him soon, I think. Job, do you wish that never would have happened? I think he would say to you, you know, before that terrible time of suffering, I had only heard of the Lord. But in that time, I saw. I had only heard with the hearing of the ear, but I began to see God. And there isn't anything else in the 210 years I would trade for that vision of his wonder and his love and his power and his majesty, his beauty, his glory. That he can just put down his heel and crush Leviathan whenever he wants, that he will crush the proud, the unjust, the wicked one day under his feet and restore equity to his creation.